Locked On NBA, the biggest stories, the local experts. Every Monday, we dig into the biggest stories in the NBA with the Locked On Podcast Network hosts. Today, we'll stop in Indiana to speak with Tony East about the Tyreke Evans suspension. Domantas Sabonis being nominated for an NBA award, and we'll give our picks for the NBA awards after the finalists have been announced. We'll go to the Bay Area to speak with Charles Hamilton of Locked On Warriors about the injuries in Golden State and them taking a 3-0 lead over the Portland Trailblazers. And lastly, we go to Cleveland to speak with Chris Manning of Locked On Cavs about the Cavs hiring a new head coach, hiring a new assistant coach, and their luck in the NBA draft lottery. It's all coming up, the biggest stories with the local experts on Locked On NBA.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hi guys, and welcome back to another episode of Locked On NBA, your Monday show. I am your Monday host, Josh Lloyd. I'm also the host of the Locked On Fantasy Basketball podcast and the lead analyst at BasketballMonster.com. Today's show is brought to you by the great people over at Grip 6 Belts. Go to Grip 6, that's grip, and then the number 6.com/LOCKE. It's also brought to you today by Hotels.com and by Untuck It. So go and support all of those three great sponsors who are helping us with today's show. Lots of NBA stuff for us to talk about now, so let's get to it. Now I bring in one of the hosts of the Locked On Pacers podcast. Tony East is here. We had some news regarding the Indiana Pacers across the weekend, Tony, with the news coming down that Tyreke Evans has been disqualified from the NBA for the next 2 years for drug-related issues. Obviously, Tyreke wasn't the same player this season in Indiana that he was last year in Memphis, where he was, you know, really got his career back on track. He'd been suspended a few times for personal issues, conduct detrimental to the team, however you want to phrase it, during the year, and now this comes out. It's obviously a terrible situation for Tyreke and his own health. What more can you sort of light can you shed on this situation?
I don't know that I have a ton of bonus info as to like what was going on with him or anything going on behind the scenes. I know in late February, early March, there was that time that you just referenced where he was injured and had a small surgery that wouldn't keep him out for a while. And then when he came back, he kept being out, and then he was out for personal reasons. So no one really ever got any transparency on what was going on there. And then he missed a game against Cleveland early in the season because he was late to a practice and missed a mandatory team event. So there was a lot of not gelling with him that happened with the actual Pacers organization. But no one had any idea what was going on with him behind the scenes in this sort of manner.
Yeah, look, my take on it early in the season, we discussed this at times, was that he just wasn't happy with the offense that Nate McMillan was running, and he was being a little bit ornery in regard to that, and you know, having the ball in his hands as much and sort of playing off ball, and it wasn't suiting his style, and he was being a little prickly in terms of the response to that. But it appears there is more stuff here behind the scenes going on with Tyreke. It's a troubling situation. Obviously, we had it with OJ Mayo a couple of years ago. We don't think he's ever coming back to the NBA. And Tyreke, at the age that he's currently at, it seems pretty unlikely that we're going to see too much more out of Tyreke Evans in the NBA, unfortunately, because he did really get his career back on track in Memphis.
Well, Birdman and Chris Anderson came back at about 30 after a two-year layoff. So I guess if you want to have hope for him, which I think you could, because I think he likes playing basketball and likes the NBA, Birdman could be the guy to draw from. But yeah, for the next 2 years minimum, he has to play in Europe or China because of how the disqualification process works. OJ Mayo played in Thailand last year, so that's also an option.
I wasn't sure of the Thai basketball league. Just that it existed, really. But interesting that OJ Mayo was playing there. Now, Evans is about to turn 30 in a couple of months' time. So by the time he comes back for that 2021-22 season, he'll be 32. That is, you know, making it tough for a guard who has struggled a little bit over the past couple of seasons. Is there any with the NBA's policy, do we have any sort of clarification as to, you know, what prompts this? Is it, you know, multiple repeated failings of drug tests? Like, how does the NBA go about, you know, metering out these sort of suspensions?
For marijuana, it's never a ban or anything like that. It's incremental 5-game suspensions that eventually just become the league picking the number of games after, like, so many, but it has to be a ton, but it's never a disqualification. And then PEDs are the same way. It's never a disqualification. The list of banned substances that get you the disqualification in the CBA are a lot of opioids and harder drugs. So those are the things they have to either have. I don't know how. I think they obviously have to detect in a drug test to confirm that it happened. But I don't know how that process goes of them determining what was used when, et cetera, if it constitutes a ban. But the list is lengthy, but it is not marijuana or PEDs. That much we do know.
Tyreek was going to be a free agent, so there was no guarantee that he was going to be back on this Indiana Pacers team for next season. But Tony, one player who will be back on the Indiana Pacers, we assume, unless some trades go down over the offseason, is the Indiana Pacers' only nominee for an NBA award, and that is Domantas Sabonis, who was nominated for the NBA Sixth Man of the Year award, along with, weirdly, two LA Clippers players, Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell. We'll go through these awards in a second, but how do you look at Sabonis' chances of nabbing this award?
I think it's lose to lose. So if you have any hope for Sabonis winning, your hope is that maybe that some people in Clipperland think it's Trez and others think it's Lou and they split some vote. But I really think there's no way Sabonis gets it. I think it's Lou's award. However, you know, he was very good off the bench and his improvement was huge, which got him up to this point. I think, you know, it's a testament how good he was that he's going to be in the top two in this award, but I don't think he's going to win. I think his chances are pretty low because of how good Lou was with 20 points and 5 assists off the bench for the Clippers.
With Sabonis, with Thaddeus Young potentially not returning to this team, do you think that the Pacers would look to incorporate him into that starting lineup alongside Miles Turner, or they'd be happy, or they'd prefer to be keeping him on the bench irrespective of Thad's situation?
I'm not sure what the exact plan is for Sabonis at this point in time. I think that depends on what happens, like you said, with that or in free agency. However, in the end of season press conference, Kevin Pritchard said in his end of season presser that Sabonis likes it here, wants to have a bigger role with the team, and he said it's imperative that they do find him that bigger role. So I think the front office, the coaching staff, is going to find a way to get Sabonis more minutes, whether that's reducing Turner's minutes or getting them more time together or starting Sabonis at the four. I think they're going to look at a lot of options to get him out there because they believe in his promise and how good he can be. It's just going to be hard to throw him at not his natural position, but if it makes the team better, then they're going to do it.
Before I let you go, Tony, we're just going to go through all of the other award finalists that have been announced, and you can just give me a quick rapid-fire pick for each of these ones. NBA Coach of the Year, Mike Budenholzer, Michael Malone, and Doc Rivers. Who have you got?
I'm going Budenholzer. 60 wins is something else.
I am going for Budenholzer as well. The NBA Most Improved Player, De'Aaron Fox, D'Angelo Russell, and Pascal Siakam.
I'm taking Siakam. I think he improved to a fringe all-star from not. I think his improvement was the largest.
I am as well. The NBA Defensive Player of the Year, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Paul George, and Rudy Gobert.
This one's the hardest one for me, but I'm taking Gobert for what he did to that Jazz defense.
Tony, it's more fun if we argue here because I'm going with Gobert as well. The NBA Sixth Man of the Year Award, we already said that one. Lou Williams is my pick, as you mentioned already. The NBA Rookie of the Year, DeAndre Ayton, Luka Doncic, and Trae Young.
Don't think we're disagreeing here. It's got to be Luka.
It does. And then the NBA MVP, the finalists are Giannis Antetokounmpo, Paul George, and James Harden.
The finalists are really just Harden and Giannis.
Yeah, they are.
I'm taking Giannis because he's on the Defensive Player of the Year award list too.
That's exactly the way that I've gone with all those. And I've mentioned this before on my Twitter and on my show, is that interestingly, if all these awards go the way that we think they will, Tony, then every award there outside of the Sixth Man of the Year will be won by a European player. And Sabonis is a European player, obviously, but he's unlikely to win it. But we're going to have Giannis as MVP, Doncic as Rookie of the Year, Gobert, or maybe even Giannis as Defensive Player of the Year, and Siakam as the Most Improved Player. So really,
wow, that's super cool.
Almost a clean sweep of European-born players. Well, not European, sorry, international-born players, because, of course, Siakam is born in Africa. So interesting dynamic shift there in the NBA. Tony, you'll have everything regarding the Pacers and their upcoming draft and offseason over on Locked On Pacers. Thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Yeah, Josh, thanks for having me.
Big thanks once again go to our sponsors for today's show, Hotels.com, Untuck It, and Grip 6 Belts. Make sure you're checking all those guys out for their great products and great offers that they have for Locked On Podcast Network listeners. Now we go across to the Bay Area to speak with the host of the Locked On Warriors podcast, Charles Hamilton, is here. The Warriors have gone up 3-0 in the series against the Portland Trail Blazers with a huge comeback in Game 3 to run out pretty comfortable 11-point victors. Charles, the last couple of games, the Game 2 and Game 3, the Blazers have looked like they've been in control at portions, you know, at times during the game, and then the Warriors just put the foot down, and that was really no more evident than it was in Game 3 as they really just exploded all over the Blazers in that fourth quarter in particular. How did they turn that game around where it wasn't looking great for them early on, but what was the big thing that changed to get the Warriors back into a commanding 3-0 lead?
Well, to me, first off, it's Draymond Green. I honestly think he might have played the best game of his career. Some might argue Game 7 of the 2016 Finals, where he, you know, went for 32 and you know, had another great game. But he literally dragged this team with him as far as he could, as long as he could. Not to mention his defense, which was stellar as always. He was pushing the pace when no one else would. And usually it starts getting people going a little bit. Like, you start to see Steph go with him and Clay. But even they were dragging, even as Draymond was going. And finally in the third, it started to translate to everyone else, really. And on top of that, not just Draymond, who was absolutely incredible. Triple-double, 20 points. I think he had 13 and 12 also. But the bench played well. Steve Kerr, some media around the Bay kind of rolls their eyes at Steve Kerr's willingness to, you know, go 12 or 13 deep on his bench. But, I mean, you can't argue the results. In the fourth, they pushed the lead up to 8, maybe 10 at one point, where Jonas Jerebko's hitting shots. Quinn Cook has a couple of nice ISOs. Alphonso McKinney filled in for Andre Iguodala for the last 7 minutes of the game. He was a plus 24 overall, had 9 rebounds, 3 offensive. It was a real team effort, and obviously Steph had, you know, another 36-point game, and Clay was solid defensively. Offense was a little inefficient, but he manages to make big shots even when he's inefficient. He manages to make shots where, you know, it gets it from 7-4 or something like that, just timely shots, really. So the main thing for Game 3 for me was Draymond. And then, obviously, just the bench, Steph, Clay. It really was a team effort, but all sparked by Draymond Green.
Now, you mentioned Andre Iguodala with that calf injury. He's listed as questionable heading into Game 4 with a commanding 3-0 lead. Do you think that there is a chance that they just sit him out of this one? They are, of course, going to be without Kevin Durant for that game as well, putting extra stress on guys like McKinney and Livingston and more minutes for Jerebko and Cook and those sort of things. But do you think that's a possibility that Kerr will just side on the side of caution there with Iguodala and that calf injury? Because, you know, going into a finals matchup with what looks like the Bucks, maybe the Raptors, Iguodala and then maybe Durant both on the sidelines, or at least if not on the sidelines, both not quite at 100%, is a little bit tougher of an ask to get over the hump there. So is there a possibility that we see Iguodala, even if he is, you know, technically right to go, that he will sit?
There's definitely a possibility. I talked about this on Locked On Warriors, where there's just so many. You just have to weigh your options, where he's questionable, and so you want to get him the rest. But then are you potentially sacrificing an extra game by not having him play at all? I mean, they came into Game 3. You found out after Game 3 that he was on a 30-minute limit, no questions asked. He ended up only playing 18 and was solid when he did play. But if you do not play him, then you're asking a lot from Alphonso McKinney, and then your wing depth is just completely depleted, which it already wasn't great in the first place. I wondered if he doesn't play, does Steve Kerr give Jacob Evans some of his first minutes of his playoff career, or, you know, the way he played Damian Jones, it's not out of the question. So there's just a lot of different options, and you're just weighing the positives and negatives. If you do play him, do you only play him another 15 minutes and pick your spots, or do you start him and just, you know, let it go? It's definitely a possibility that they sit him, but you're also dealing with Andre Iguodala, who might say, no, I'm good to go. It might be a battle between, say, the training staff and coaching staff and Andre Iguodala as far as, you know, whether he plays or not. But he also, I think it was Draymond who said, you know, Andre told him that he was going to be good to go on Monday. So I don't know. It's definitely one of the biggest questions going into Game 4.
Yeah, Damian Jones did make a surprise return, I think Game 2 or Game 1. He'd been out for the season with that torn pectoral muscle. He came in, he started, probably the worst start you'll ever see out of anybody in any NBA mm-hmm. game. 3 minutes, three fouls, didn't play again. Do you think that we'll get him as a starter again? They moved Andrew Bogut out. Well, clearly, Kevon Looney is the guy that is playing all the bulk of these center minutes. I'm just not sure what Kerr's reticence is to actually just put him in there with that group. Obviously, Draymond plays some center when Kevin Durant's around. But what do we think of this Damian Jones starting situation? And to dovetail that out, what's the latest on DeMarcus Cousins' return? I've heard some whispers, or maybe he could come back at some point during these playoffs. Is there anything concrete with that?
Well, so as far as the Kevon Looney thing goes, I mean, I agree with you, but Steve Kerr has said he's not a 35-minute-a-game type of guy and never really elaborated on it. I don't know if that's conditioning or if you play him that long, he might be exposed somehow. He is a little undersized. He's, you know, about 6'9", 220, 230, but at the same time, he is their best center. So I don't understand the reasoning myself either. But I kind of predicted that Damian Jones might start, especially the way that Steve Kerr played Bogut for about 3 minutes in game two, and then pulled him like immediately, and then started Kevon Looney in the second half. Another part of it is just his relationship with Jordan Bell is one of the weirdest things I've seen in Steve Kerr's entire tenure with the Warriors, where Jordan Bell during the regular season, he's not getting off the bench in a game against Portland. Now he's getting, you know, 15, 20 minutes in the Western Conference Finals against them and playing well. So I think he's earned probably a start if he's not going to go with Bogut. I think the best option is Jordan Bell. But again, I jokingly thought that he'd start Damian Jones, and sure enough, he did it. So I really don't know where he's going to go with it. Maybe you go back to Bogut and just try and steal, you know, 6 minutes overall, three at the beginning of the first half, three at the beginning of the second half. I really don't know. That's another weird option for Steve Kerr where he just, I mean, hell, maybe he starts Jonas Jerebka. Probably not, but you never know with him. And then as far as DeMarcus Cousins goes, he has been cleared for, I think 3-on-3 contact. So he's not going full bore yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if he does make a return in the finals, assuming the Warriors make it, obviously up 3-0. I think we all think they will. Technically, he's closer than Kevin Durant, but since his injury was worse, you know, the rehab is, you probably want to see him take contact longer than you would Kevin Durant, et cetera. But the first game isn't until the 30th for the finals, I believe. So there's still, you know, what, 9-10 days until then. I would expect, honestly, everyone be ready to go. KD and Iguodala good to go at the start of the finals, and Boogie start or somewhere in the middle. Like, I wouldn't be surprised to see him active and back at a certain point.
It's going to be very interesting to watch how all this plays out for these Warriors. Injuries, Iguodala, Durant, and, of course, Cousins as they look to wrap up this series against Portland. Charles will have that covered for everybody over on Locked On Warriors over the coming weeks and into the NBA Finals, assuming that some historic incident doesn't occur and they don't make it in. Charles, thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Yeah, anytime, man. I wish I had more concrete answers for you, but that's... I don't know what he's going to do, but it's always pretty interesting.
Let's now bring in the host of the Locked On Cavaliers podcast. Chris Manning is back with us here. A few things have developed with the Cavs over the last 5-6 days, I believe. Chris, they have we've got the results of the NBA lottery. They've hired a new head coach. They've hired a new, I believe the title for JB Bickerstaff is associate head coach. Let's go through what's happened here with Cleveland. John Beilein has been hired out of Michigan to be the Cavs' new head coach, and Bickerstaff, who seemed to be in demand as a top assistant coach, has signed with Cleveland as well. What do these two hirings mean? Is it just, you know, full steam ahead on the development train for the Cavs now?
I think so, and I think if you compare it to last time I hired a coach, there are some similarities. When they hired David Blatt and Tyronn Lue at the same time, I think it was a little more patchwork, it was a little more thrown together, but I think you look at this one, you bring in John Beilein, who, you know, was known for setting a culture at Michigan and runs an offense that a lot of people smarter than me believe will translate well to the NBA. You get that guy in there, but then you get a guy in GB Bickerstaff who was a head coach for two teams, for the Rockets and the Grizzlies, was surprisingly fired based on sort of how that seemed to play out in Memphis. He seemed to be well liked by his players, and you know, maybe he did an interview for the Cavs job as well. Had his father, Bernie Bickerstaff, also does work for the organization, but you have a guy that's going to come in and can help John Beilein adjust to, you know, working with NBA players, working with the 82-game schedule, the lack of practices are things he's not going to be familiar with because he's never coached in the NBA before, even though he's been a coach for like his whole adult life. So Bickerstaff's going to come, and I think it's a good pairing. It seems like Beilein is coming in with very little ego about all of this and being willing to learn and being willing to adapt to a lot of this. So I do like it, and I think it was actually – I think on paper this was two pretty smart moves by the Cavs organization.
I was pretty critical of JB Bickerstaff being hired in Memphis in the first place. I don't have any problem with him being fired with the Grizzlies. I thought, look, they provided some fight at the beginning of the season, terrible in the middle of the year, some fight at the end of the season, but a lot of his decision-making was poor. But this, to me, is the perfect role for where he fits as this associate head coach, helping transition people, develop players, but be just a word... A conduit even between the head coach and the players. I think this is the perfect role for Bickerstaff. He's out of his depth as a head coach, but this is perfect for him here, underneath Beilein for the head coaching position. I couldn't think of a better situation, and he was in demand as that associate head coach right across the league. Now, translating from college to the NBA doesn't always go successfully. Brad Stevens has had success, but plenty of other college coaches haven't. Billy Donovan, I guess he's in the middle of the mix there, but and Beilein coming across here from Michigan, what do we know of what he's done in terms of schemes? Is he an up-tempo coach? Is he slow it down? Are we focusing more defensively, offensively? What do we know here from what he's done during his time with the Wolverines?
So his offense is – he's known for his offense. He's a guy that is amendable. He's a guy that is flexible. He's not a super rigid, my system is the only system in it. This is, and that's been in place for 30 years kind of guy. He's a guy that can adjust and adapt things as he needs to. And I think that's a really key thing to know about him. His offense, generates a lot of threes. There's a lot of movement. There's a lot of ball screens there. There's bigs that shoot. So I think the Cavs have some personnel that should fit it. I think they can get better personnel to fit it. And I think it's the kind of – It to me, based on watching, doing a quick deep dive in film, and people I might be wrong about this, but I think it's an offense that doesn't necessarily need like a star elite player to make it work. I think I think every NBA team wants that, but if you look at these Michigan teams, these coaches that have been very successful, it's not as if they were, having top 100 recruits or guys that were going to be named player of the years and high lottery picks. Like Nick Skauskas was, a lottery pick, but he was not a top 100 recruit. These are teams that are successful based on the system, based on the way he can get guys to execute that system, and he coaches them up. And I think that's a thing the Cavs are going to base on. Now you obviously want to get a guy that can be the feature of that and kind of be your guy, and that matters, I think, probably more in the NBA than it does in college. But I think it's a good system for an organization that seems to actually be trying to build some culture and stability. I think that's a really interesting sign for them to go out and get John Beilein to do what he's going to do.
Now, the Cavs have had some extraordinarily great luck in the lottery over past years, Chris. It wasn't the case this year as they dropped all the way down to pick number 5 despite having one of the three worst records in the NBA and having the highest chance of getting that number 1 pick all the way down to number 5 as the Lakers, the Grizzlies, and the Pelicans all jumped ahead of them in that draft lottery to finish at number 5. This is a draft that universally is being thought of as perhaps not as strong and really Zion, and then it's the rest. And at the way things are currently looking, I think we're looking at Zion, Ja Morant, RJ Barrett being the first 3 picks there. After that, things can go a little bit off the rails. So what sort of, obviously it's disappointing for the Cavs to end up with pick number 5 here when they could have had that chance at number 1. But what sort of player are we looking at in this area? What areas of need is Kobe Altman going to be looking at? Well, not that they're in really a position where they should be focusing entirely on need, but say a guy, say Ja Morant inexplicably falls to number 5, or someone like Darius Garland is around there at number 5. Do the Cavs look to still just acquire talent, or are they completely sold on, say, Colin Sexton or Chetty Osman on the wing? How are they going to be approaching this pick?
Well, I think that would be an interesting question. Garland, not so much. I think there's a lot of overlap with Sexton. I think Morant could be interesting just because Beilein's offense does ask a lot of his point guards, and the draft could be a referendum on what he thinks of Sexton to some degree. I don't think that's a crazy thing to suggest. For me, the two guys that I'm most interested at 5 would be DeAndre Hunter from Virginia and Jarrett Culver from Texas Tech. I think the Cavs, you know, if five obviously is not ideal, they would have liked to get Bear. They would have liked to, you know, maybe get picks back for Jeff for a team that really wanted Ja, or they could have taken Ja, or obviously Zion would have been great. But I think in Culver, there's a guy that could be a creator that could, you know, come in and be a good defender and kind of fit the Beeline system well. You know, Caris LeVert, who played for John Beeline in Michigan, kind of was a big wing creator, and I think Culver could do that. And Hunter's projects to be that prototype 3-and-D guy. So I think they could get use out of all those guys. I think wing is the biggest position of need for them. So I think Culver or Hunter, excuse me, at five, I think would make a lot of sense. I also think, you know, depending on what they want to do, you know, maybe a team like Atlanta that has 8 and 10, that maybe they want to go get one specific guy to pair with Trae Young and John Collins and Kevin Huerter. Maybe they trade back and do something there. I think that shouldn't be written off, but I think if they stay at five, Culver and Hunter would be the two guys I would kind of look at the most.
If I was in charge of the Lakers, which, hey, they do have a president of basketball operations position available, I'll happily take that. I'd be looking at taking Culver there at four, but I agree, if he does fall to five, he's definitely in the mix there for the Cavs. It's going to be very interesting over this offseason to see how everything pans out. The Cavs have their coach, have their assistant head coach or associate head coach as well. Now, so things are starting to take shape for Cleveland. Chris Manning will have the rest of the information for you across the offseason, the preseason, the draft, free agency, all that sort of stuff, over on Locked On Cavaliers. Chris, thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Thanks, Josh.
And that'll do it for another episode of Locked On NBA. Make sure you're following me on Twitter at @RedRock_Beeble and follow the network at Locked On NBA Net on both Twitter and on Instagram. Subscribe to this podcast. Give us a 5-star rating, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. And a big thanks to today's sponsors, Hotels.com. Don't hate like your friend's trip. Book your own with Hotels.com and get rewarded basically everywhere. Hotels.com, be there, do that, and get rewarded. We're also brought to you by Untuck It. Dads come in all shapes and sizes, and so should their shirts, like tall, short, slim, and relaxed. If you ever wonder why your father's button-ups look so long and baggy at the end of the day, it can be hard for guys to pull off a casual, untucked look that isn't sloppy, and that's where Untuck It comes in. It's the solution that fits just right. Their shirts are specifically designed to look great untucked and feel comfortable at work or on the weekend. No tucking or tailoring required. Go to untuckit.com and use the promo code NBA to get 20% off. And lastly, Grip 6 Belts. Their goal is to literally make the best belt that's ever been made, and I can personally vouch for that. Their belts are absolutely fantastic. Grip 6 is an easy, thoughtful gift for dads, brothers, husbands, uncles, grandpas, and even mums and wives, and they even have a kids range as well. I'm going to be looking to get a couple of belts for my son there too. Ultra lightweight, no holes, no flap, carries a low profile with a buckle laying flat against the waist, making the belt super comfortable. It's the only belt with no holes, no flap, and no bulk. Grip 6 has a special offer for you at grip6.com/lock, L-O-C-K-E, grip6.com/lock. Guys, we are done here. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.